I am reminded again this week with my mother-in-law's passing of times of trouble, times of trial. And I didn't know that this was going to happen when I was looking to prepare this message this week, but the title of the message, as you see in your bulletin, is Tenacity in Times of Trial. Turn in your Bibles, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 30. 1 Samuel chapter 30. Thinking about that word tenacity. Tenacity is a word that I like. It means to hold persistently to something. If you're tenacious, you hold persistently to something and you won't let go. Can you think of any verses in the Bible that encourage us to be tenacious? In other words, holding persistently to something and not letting go. Don't you believe that one of the characteristics of a believer is that he should be tenacious, persistently holding to something and won't let go? Let me just share some verses in the Bible that have to do with being tenacious. In Philippians 1:27, and again in chapter 4 and verse 1, you have this command, this imperative: stand fast. Colossians 1:23, continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved. Does that sound like tenacity to you? 2 Thessalonians 2:15, stand fast and hold. 1 Corinthians 16:13, watch ye, stand fast in the faith, quit you like men, be strong. Look at all those words that the Apostle Paul uses there. Quit you like men. Stand in the faith. Be strong. That phrase that says quit you like men is literally translated act like men. When my boys were little, I would meet with them once a week and we'd have what we called our Andridzamai club. Andridzamai is that phrase, quit you like men, act like men. And I would just meet with them and I'd say, okay, this is Andridzamai. These are just little guys. Okay, this is Andridzamai. And I would teach them how to shake somebody's hand. You look them in the eye. You don't look away. You look them in the eye when you shake their hands. You give them a good, strong, firm handshake. And we would go through all knot tying and things like that. I would get the Boy Scout book and figure out how to tie knots myself before I tried to teach them. And I can't even remember what I taught them when it comes to that. But it was just act like men. God made you boys, so act like men. Andridzamai, stand fast, be tenacious. 2 Timothy 2:5 or 4:5 says, endure afflictions. Does that sound like tenacity? James 5:11, behold, we count them happy which endure tenacity. 1 Peter 5:8-9, resist the devil, being steadfast in the faith. Does that sound like tenacity? Folks, we need to be tenacious, holding persistently to something, not letting go. But it gets hard when the trials come, doesn't it? When the trials come, you want to let go. You want to let loose because I can't take this any longer. Back in the 1970s, I remember as a teenager reading an article that just stunned me. It must have been in the newspaper because I remember reading this article about this Japanese soldier from World War II. They had just found in the jungles of the Philippines. He had been waiting to get command orders from his headquarters that the war was over and he could come home. This last Thursday, that man passed away. That's what reminded me of it. And I thought of that tenacity again. There was an article entitled, Japan's Last World War II Straggler Soldier, 91, Dies. Hiro Onoda, the last Japanese Imperial soldier to emerge from hiding in a jungle in the Philippines and surrender 29 years after the end of World War II, has died. He was 91 this last Thursday. Tenacity. After World War II, Mr. Onoda lived in the jungle for many years and then he returned to Japan And when he returned to Japan, I felt that finally the war was finished. That's how I felt, he said. He was an intelligence officer who came out of hiding, erect, but emaciated. And they had pictures of him. He was standing tall, but emaciated. In fatigues, patched many times over on Lubang Island in the Philippines in March 1974 on his 52nd birthday. He surrendered only when his commander, his former commander, flew there to reverse his 1945 orders to stay behind and spy on American troops. Before and after, before and during the war, Japanese soldiers were taught absolute loyalty to the nation and the emperor. Soldiers in the Imperial Army observed a code that said death was preferable to surrender. I see a lot of parallels here with what we are called to be as Christians. Death before surrender. Onada refused to give up, despite at least four searches during which family members appealed to him over loudspeakers and flights dropped leaflets urging him to surrender. In his formal surrender to Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, Onada wore his 30-year-old Imperial Army uniform, cap and sword, all still in good condition. Quote, "I don't consider those 30 years a waste of time," Onada said in a 1995 interview. "Without that experience, I wouldn't have my life today." Still, he showed a great zeal for making up years lost. "I do everything twice as fast so I can make up for the 30 years," he said. "I wish someone could eat and sleep for me so I can work 24 hours a day." And the article goes on and gives more information. But what struck me was this man's tenacity. Firmly holding on. Talk about a trial. Talk about being alone. And yet he tenaciously fulfilled his orders until finally the article says his commander flew there, who was still alive back in 1974, and said, "Onada, you can give up. The war is over." Then and only then he surrendered. But the question is, when times are hard, how can you be tenacious? We can learn from the example of David and his deliverance from distress right here in 1 Samuel chapter 30. Are you there with me? Let's look there, because here we have this familiar Old Testament character, David. Let's just give a little history in 1 Samuel first. He was anointed king in 1 Samuel chapter 16, just a young boy. In chapter 17, David fought against Goliath. In chapter 18, the ladies, the women declared that Saul had killed his thousands, but David his 10,000s. In chapters 19 to 26, David is fleeing from the king, King Saul. In chapter 27, he escapes to the enemy. In chapter 29, he attempts to fight against his own people with the enemy, the Philistines. But God providentially rescues him from having to fight his own people. Now you get to chapter 30. And now you've got another trial. This time this trial has to do with David's own men. Not the Philistines, not his enemy Saul, but his own men, the people who were following him. A tremendous trial. Starting with chapter 29 and verse 8, would you please follow with me? "And David said unto Achish, But what have I done? And what hast thou found in thy servant so long as I have been with thee unto this day, that I may not go out and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" He's fighting with the Philistines. "And Achish answered and said to David, I know that thou art good in my sight as an angel of God. Notwithstanding, the princes of the Philistines have said, He shall not go up with us to battle. Wherefore now arise up early in the morning with thy master's servants that are come with thee. And as soon as ye be up early in the morning and have light, depart. So David and his men rose up early to depart in the morning to return into the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel." Now, David had already established a city that the Philistines had given him. It was a city called Ziklag. The Philistine commander says, "You can't go with us, David. My men think that you're going to reverse on us. You're going to turn on us when the battle gets hot because you're going to be fighting against King Saul. They just don't trust you. I do, but they don't. I'm sorry, you can't go with us. You need to go back to your hometown. Go back to your wives and your children back in Ziklag." Now let's read in verse 1. "And it came to pass when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and smitten Ziklag and burned it with fire. and had taken the women captives that were therein. They slew not any, either great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. So David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned with fire. And their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captives. Then David and the people that were with him lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives were taken captives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And David was greatly distressed. Stop there. David was greatly distressed. What is David going to do? I call this David's despair. That's the first thing I want you to see. And I want to see if you can identify with this valley that David is going through, the depth of his despair. What were the causes of this despair? Well, his plans were disrupted. You go back to chapter 29 that I read those verses. He wanted to fight with the Philistines. He had become loyal to the Philistine commander. He wouldn't let him, and his plans were disrupted. That's part of his despair. He's been running from Saul, and now his plans are thwarted. He knows he's supposed to be the king of Israel, and maybe thought that this is how it's going to happen, by conquering his way to the throne against Saul, because Saul had pursued him twice. David had opportunity twice to kill Saul. He wouldn't do it. Now he's thinking, maybe this is what God is allowing me to do in order to get the throne that God has promised me. Have you ever had your plans thwarted when you had everything figured out? Have you ever come through a tremendous trial where you finally saw the light and you go, hey, this is what I can do. And you start following those plans, and then those plans are thwarted, disrupted. You don't know what you're going to do. Now, in hindsight, it shows that God had hindered David from having to fight for the enemy against his own people. It was providential. But it is frustrating when you try everything and you get nowhere. You make plans only to have those plans fall apart. I think I'm speaking to folks who understand exactly what I'm talking about. That's the first cause of David's despair, plans disrupted. Here's the second thing that caused David's despair, homes destroyed. There in verses 1 to 3, he had just been given Ziklag, the city, in chapter 27 and verse 6. He had been this nomad in the wilderness, constantly running from Saul, hiding in caves, hiding in the wilderness, trying to get away from Saul. Finally, he's got this hometown, a place that he can run to after months of running from Saul. No doubt, they probably had new homes. He and his people were settled down, establishing themselves. And you see in verses 1 to 3, it's all destroyed. Homes destroyed. Well, you would say, well, at least I have my family. Well, that's the third thing about his despair. Families endangered, that we read in verses 4 to the first part of verse 6. They arrive in Ziklag and they find out what? Families have been kidnapped. Wives, sons, daughters. You know what? You can take away somebody's house, but the family's the foundation. The family is what makes a house a home. That's when things get bad. You can have a house, but without a family, that house is meaningless. That was another cause of his despair. And then we see, fourthly, emotions crumbled. Look at verse 4. He wept until he couldn't weep anymore. His men wept until they couldn't weep anymore. These are men, folks. These are warriors. 600 men weeping until they could not weep anymore. And now go to verse 6. I haven't read this part, but let's continue in verse 6. David was greatly distressed. Why? The people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved. All of the men were bitter in soul, and it's shown by their attitude that somebody's going to have to pay for this. David, let's make him pay for this. Notice how they're dealing with their distress. Let's take it out on someone. Let's make someone pay for this. Have you ever been tempted to be that way when you're in a time of trial, despair? You know what? I'm going to make somebody pay. David was greatly distressed too. I'll look that word up, that word distressed. It has the idea of being confined in a narrow, tight place. All of your options are gone. You can't go forward. You can't go to the right. You can't go to the left. And you can't back up. Now, does that describe any situations you've been in? You don't know where to turn. You don't know where to go. In a tight place, confined. You see, we do well as long as we have plenty of alternatives and plenty of options. We do fine as long as, well, I can always do this. Well, I always still have the nest egg. Well, we still have money and savings. Well, we have... But folks, what is it like when there's no place to turn? That's the situation David finds himself in. That's the situation his men find themselves in. Confined. When there's no second car, when the first one's in the shop. No other job possibilities and perhaps no other medical treatments. And you feel like, I have no options. The whole nation of Israel found themselves in a place like this once. They had come out with a high hand out of Egypt. Everything was great. They were rejoicing. They were marching. And they got to the Red Sea. And they said, now where do we go? And they looked to the right. There's mountains on the right. They looked to the left. Mountains on the left. And they thought, well, let's just turn around and go another way. They looked behind them and there's the Egyptian army. They are in a narrow, tight, confined place where they can go no direction. And by the way, when you're in a tight situation like that where you can't go left, right, front, or back, you tend to look up and say, maybe I can go up. And that's where God wants us, is where we can look up and look up to Him. Well, you expect after this David's despair, let's move on to David's victory. That would make a good outline, right? First 2 points, David's despair, David's victory. No. David's victory is point three. Before you get to that, you've got point two, David's focus. And I'm challenging you with this because this is what we need to do. What does David do when he's in despair? He didn't remain in that condition for long. If you have the wrong focus, it's going to complicate matters, folks. If you focus on your circumstances, it's going to get complicated. If you focus on yourself and the misery you're in, it's going to get complicated. Things might get worse. But I will say this, it is hard sometimes to have the right focus. Because it's easier sometimes to blame God than do what David did. What does David do? Well, I haven't finished reading verse 6 yet. Let's start with the first part of that verse again. David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters, but David. What did David do? David encouraged himself. David encouraged himself. You see, David went to go see Bob Shuler out at the Crystal Cathedral in California, who says, think positively. Think positively, David. Think positively. Encourage yourself. You can do it. You can do it. I don't know why you're laughing. Did I say something? That's the idea. Now, David went to the psychologist. The psychologist said, come on, David. You can do it. You can just, you know, if you just think positively, it's your attitude. It's how you're thinking. I left something out, which I often like to do, to have us focus on the three important words there. But David encouraged himself, please finish it for me, in the Lord. David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. That's all it says. Wow, what are we going to learn from that? How do I encourage myself in the Lord my God? How do I do that? Well, nothing is given here. So I began to think, okay, what is characteristic of David's life? How did he encourage himself in the Lord his God? And I found at least two or three things. Number one, Ask yourself this question. Am I willing to recall? In other words, am I willing to go back and look at how God has taken care of me in the past? Am I willing to recall? Would you ask yourself that question next time you get into a bad situation? Am I willing to recall? God has been his help in the past. You say, but God has never delivered me in the past. If you say that, then you've never been saved because he delivered you when you got saved. David could recall much. Could David go back and think about a time when he came up against somebody bigger than he? Well, we already looked at that in 1 Samuel 17 when he fought with Goliath. Go with me to Psalm 77, a psalm where we see great encouragement, a psalm of encouragement, Psalm 77 and verse 2. Look what this psalmist says. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My sore ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. But notice, in the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. Verse 3, I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. But he is at least seeking the Lord in the time of his trouble. You know what? Sometimes when we say, well, I'm going to pray about this, we think, I'm going to wake, get up from my knees and everything's going to be great. No, the trouble still continues. The heart of trouble still continues. By the way, that word trouble has the same idea of distress here that David was enduring. Go down to verses 10 and 13, 10 and 11 and 12. Here in Psalm 77, verse 10, and I said, this is my infirmity, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. I will meditate also of all thy work and talk of thy doings. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? Now, folks, when you start thinking this way, when you get the focus off of my troubles and off of my trials and you begin to focus on the Lord my God, you're on the way to recovery. It's not a matter of having positive thinking. It's a matter of having God thinking. And a thinking not of how great you are and how you can get yourself out of this if you just have the right mental attitude. It's how great is your God? You know, there was a nation that we read about in the Old Testament that had a recall problem. Remember the question you're supposed to ask yourself is, am I willing to recall? What nation had a problem recalling things? It was the nation of Israel. You read in Psalm 78, if you're still there in Psalm 77, go to the next chapter, look at verse 11, Psalm 78, 11. They forget his works and his wonders that he had showed them. Time and again, God would deliver the children of Israel. Let's just use an example. He brings them through the Red Sea. Wow. Tremendous miracle. The Egyptians who are chasing them, they watch as God drowns their enemy in the Red Sea. And you have all kinds of praise and singing in Exodus 15 when they come through the Red Sea. But at the very end of that chapter, they're already complaining again because something else came up. Go back and remember what God just did. And folks, that's what we need to do, is just go back and remember what God has done. It stems from unbelief. If you're still there in Psalm 78, go to verse 22. Because they believed not in God. That is the problem. They believed not in God. So bitterly, we might say, well, that was another time. That was another group of people. Yeah, God always took care of them, but I've never seen him do anything like that to me. That won't happen to me. Have you ever seen where the Lord... somebody gave a testimony on how the Lord had provided for somebody in a miraculous way. And you're thinking, that's great, but I wish God would do the same thing for me. I struggled in college. I struggled financially. It was very difficult. I remember my freshman year going to the man who was in charge of the work scholarship program on campus. They called it a work scholarship. The scholarship was you got to work. And so I was working three jobs. I would work at night. I would, when everybody else went to bed, I was up for an hour to an hour and a half cleaning the dormitory. Saturday, all day long, I worked yard crew. I would work sometimes 12 hours on Saturday, picking up leaves, sweeping, doing all kinds of things. Then I would work on as an usher whenever there were programs on campus. I felt like I was either working my work scholarship or I was studying. I didn't feel like I was getting enough sleep. I was constantly working. I'd come to prayer meeting, and here's this guy who doesn't even have a job, doesn't have to work. But he would say, you know what, I need $500 to pay my school bill this month. And guess what? $500 came in the mail today. And I'm thinking, how come it happens to him? Why is it that how come that never happens to me? I never had a time when I could recall where God had ever done anything like that for me. And it almost came to the place where I could get bitter about it. But then I began to think, you know what? This is what God has for me. So I'm going to accept it. Then I began to see the Lord work. That's when I got this note in my post office box one day that said, somebody put $1,000 on your school bill. Now, folks, this is when a year of college was $2,700. Somebody put $1,000 on your school bill. Wow. Now, I could go to prayer meeting and say, guys, guess what happened? Somebody put money on my school bill. Not just mine. I got some money. God is taking care of me. Then when things would get difficult later on, you know what I could do? I could go back and point to that time when, you know, God took care of me in the past. He'll do it again. My question is, are you willing to recall what God has done in the past? When you recall God's past blessings, guess what? You become thankful. When you're willing to thank God for hardships of the past, you're ready to thank Him for the hardships of today and even the hardships that might come in the future. And then I would go to class and I would see above the blackboards this quote from Dr. Bob Jones Sr. When gratitude dies on the altar of a man's heart, that man is well nigh hopeless. Being thankful for what God is doing for me right now. So there's your first question. When times of trial come, you're in a tight, confining place. Am I willing to recall? Number two, I believe David could ask himself this question. Am I willing to trust? Am I willing to trust? Turn to Psalm chapter 9. Psalm chapter 9. Verses 9 and 10. The Lord also will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. And they that know thy name will put their trust in thee, for thou, Lord, hast not forsaken them that seek thee. That word trouble there is the same word distress you find in 1 Samuel 30 and verse 6. If you would go to Psalm 46 and verse 1, you'll find that it says this: God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. It's the same word distress you're going to find in 1 Samuel 30 and verse 6. A very present help in distress. Well, am I willing to trust? Well, am I willing to trust what? Am I willing to trust whom? Am I willing to trust in the Lord? Notice what it says there again in verse 6 of 1 Samuel 30. David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. Well, you know how I like words. Well, I'm going to study that word encouraged. What does it mean? He encouraged himself. And so I did a little study on my own about where that word encouraged is translated, where else it's found in the Old Testament. This is interesting because I found that in Joshua chapter 1 and verse 9, the same word encouraged here is used when God is talking to Joshua. And he says, have not I commanded thee, be strong. There's that word encouraged. Be encouraged, be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee, whithersoever thou goest. So the word encouraged here can also be translated to strengthen. David strengthened himself in the Lord. Well, that was interesting. Well, then I found that that word is also used in another passage, but it's translated differently. You remember when Pharaoh was doing something to his own heart because of his resisting God? Pharaoh would see what was taking place with all the plagues that were coming, and Pharaoh, when Moses and Aaron would stand before him, would relent for a little while, but then he would turn back, and something was happening to his heart. His heart was becoming hard. And the Bible says Pharaoh hardened his heart. You know what I found out that was interesting? Is the same word encouraged here, is the same word used, hardened. David hardened his heart. You say, oh, that's bad. No, wait, let's finish the verse. David hardened his heart in the Lord his God. Not against the Lord his God. David hardened his heart in the Lord his God. In other words, his heart was becoming more firm. Regardless of what happens, my heart is hard with God. So I found that that was interesting. But as I went to in my study, I found out that it was translated another way. When David slew the lion and the bear, in 1 Samuel 17:35 and 37, David says this, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. The Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. That word caught, I caught him by his beard and smote him, is the same word translated encouraged in 1 Samuel 30, verse 6. So I got to thinking, what does that mean? Well, the word caught means to take hold of. Let's translate it that way. Go back to 1 Samuel 30, verse 6. But David took hold of himself in the Lord, his God. Has anybody ever said, come on, get a grip? Now, as a believer, I might get a grip. But what am I going to grip? David gripped himself in the Lord, his God. He was holding on to the Lord. I found out it was translated another way in another passage. This is all very instructive when you do a Bible study, a word study like this. Nehemiah uses a word 33 times in the book named after him. What was Nehemiah involved in? Nehemiah was working on the gates in Jerusalem. The gates in Jerusalem had been broken down, and Nehemiah came there to do something to those gates. He came there to repair them. To repair them. To bring them back to their original condition. And so you'll find that 33 times in the book of Nehemiah, you'll find the word repair or to repair. That's the word, again, encourage here in 1 Samuel 30 and verse 6. David repaired himself in the Lord. Folks, when you're in despair, repair yourself in the Lord your God. David would at times talk sense to himself. I once read a book by D. Martin Lloyd-Jones on spiritual depression. When you get depressed, I would encourage you to do the same thing that David did. He would ask this question of himself. Are you ready? Why art thou cast down, O my soul? And why art thou disquieted within me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him who is the health of my countenance and my God. That's found in Psalm 42 and verse 11. David would say, why are you cast down, my soul? Why are you cast down? And he would literally talk sense to himself. Why am I cast down? So the question is, are you willing to trust? Thirdly, am I willing to wait? Are you willing to wait? You know what? If I've got a problem, I want the solution right now. Children and their immaturity don't like to wait, but God's solution sometimes requires that you wait. You can bring the tension back up here. I know we heard the phone ringing, but that's all gone, okay? God's solution sometimes requires waiting. Psalm 27, 14, wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen thine heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. Think of Psalm 40, verses 1 to 3, I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined unto me and heard my cry. Are you willing to wait on the Lord? Even if it's longer than you like? David encouraged himself in the Lord. And then you'll see in verses 7 and 8, secondly, that David inquired at the Lord. And David said to Abiathar the priest, verse 7, Ahimelech's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. And Abiathar brought hither the ephod to David. And David inquired at the Lord, saying, shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he answered him, pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. David inquired at the Lord. Are you willing to pray? Sometimes one of the things that's hard to do when you're in times of trouble is to pray. Because the matter that needs to be dealt with is right here at hand. I don't need to pray. I got to get busy here. No. Inquire at the Lord. Does prayer really work? Listen to Psalm 18:6. In my distress, I called upon the Lord and cried unto my God. He heard my voice out of his temple, and my cry came before him, even into his ears. Are you willing to pray? I told you the story before, but years ago, when we were meeting in the elementary school, we got word from the district that said, listen, you've got one more month in the school. We're sorry, but the janitor's not going to be available. You have to have a janitor in order to be at the school. So I thought, well, no big deal. I'll just find another place for us to meet as a church. I spent days driving around Greeley, days talking on the telephone trying to find another place to meet. I went to other elementary schools. I went to high schools. Nobody was able to help us. I went back to the district office and I said, couldn't you please give us another place to meet? No, there's no other place to meet. And after I had done everything, folks, I went back and I went to the house and I sat back in the chair and I closed my eyes and said, Lord, I've done everything I can. I don't know what else to do. And the phone rang. Now, you always hear stories like this, don't you? It did. I closed my eyes and sat back and was praying, Lord, I don't know what else to do. And the phone rang. It was the lady from the district office. She said, hey, listen, we found somebody who is willing to be the janitor. You can stay in the school where you are for as long as you need it. The Lord just took care. I had prayed and said, Lord, it's in your hands. I don't know what else to do. I'm just trusting you. And the Lord came in. I think it was just a period of trial he wanted to take me through to prove us. Well, there's David's focus. Now let's get to David's victory. Because you'll see in verses 9 to 20, and we don't have time to read this, that David's victory was providentially devised. Immediately, he began to act on what God had told him in verses 7 and 8. And it just so happened. Are you listening to me? It was a coincidence. He was lucky one day to run into somebody. Now, you know I'm using those words facetiously. It was providential that David came upon a servant of the Ziklag invaders. And he began to inform them of who these invaders were and where they had taken their wives and their kids. Providentially devised. David's victory was providentially devised. Why? Because David learned to wait on the Lord, to trust in the Lord, and to recall God's victories in the past. So in verses 9 to 20, you see that his victory was providentially devised. In verses 21 to 25, you see that everything that David had lost, he recovered. Everything. David conquered by God's help. But there were some men who didn't go all the way, because there were some men who came to a brook and they said, we're tired, we can't go any further. They're pursuing after these men. 200 men said, we're sorry, this is it, we're tired. David left them there and he took 400 men. They went, recovered all their spoil, and they came back. What do you think those 400 men said about the 200 men? He said, these guys don't get any of the spoil. Okay, they get their wives, they get their kids, but they don't get anything else. Because they didn't go with us to the battle. And that's when David spoke and said, look at verse 24. Who will hearken unto you in this matter? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike. And so David proportionally divides what was taken. You guys who stayed by the stuff are just as important as those of us who went on. You guarded while we fought. We fought while you guarded. And David honors God in his victory. And then he takes all the spoil, the extra things that they got of us. By the way, this is interesting. Not only did they get their things back, did they get anything extra? Yeah, they got all the spoil from the enemy now. Now all of a sudden David has this wealth that he has. What am I going to do with all this wealth? You remember somebody else who went through tremendous trial in the Old Testament who at the end was blessed so much better than at the beginning? Thinking about Job. And so David takes some of the spoil and he sends it to his friends in various cities. And he begins to establish himself thereby as a leader in all Israel. And then you know what happens in the next chapter, Psalm or 1 Samuel chapter 31? David's enemy is providentially removed. And all of a sudden you get to 2 Samuel, and who's the king? David's the king. Isn't it interesting that 1 Samuel 30 and 31 are such times of trial and despair and distress and depression, and this is it, and the very next book, and David's king? Isn't it interesting how many times, if we handle problems and trials correctly, if we do it in the Lord, that the very next thing you find out is all of a sudden blessings beyond what we could have imagined? Is there someone here in distress this morning? Is there someone here whose plans have been disrupted? Is it perhaps a time of insecurity? I don't know how God's going to arrange for your victory, but I can assure you that no matter how confined you are in your circumstance, if you encourage yourself in the Lord and if you inquire of Him, He will grant you the victory, even as He did for David. Lord, we pray that You would do the same for us, as we do the same that David did.